From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, what health workers and the rest of us should consider as we follow the story of the Ebola outbreak in Africa. Later, why the future of the Mary Knoll House in Fox Point is such a thorny issue.
I think it is that conflict that made it kind of noteworthy. I mean, it's definitely an interesting piece in and of itself, especially with it being one of the only works of outsider art or vernacular art done by a woman. But I think the thing that made it kind of this magazine-worthy piece is the fact that there was such a strong reaction to it when they wanted to build it into a museum.
The latest in our Listening to Mitchell series, and we'll hear the distinctive sound of a centuries-old Turkish flute, the ney. Lake Effect comes your way next after this news update. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. The World Health Organization announced yesterday that its researchers believe the Ebola outbreak in Africa could eventually sicken or kill 20,000 people before it's brought under control. Several thousand people have died in the outbreak in four countries: Sierra Leone, Liberia, Guinea, and Nigeria. The gruesome nature of the deaths and the speed with which the outbreak has spread in Africa have led to concerns around the world about both Ebola and the possibility of any sort of pandemic. In the Milwaukee area, Dr. Angela Tanazi has gotten her share of questions. She's Aurora Healthcare's System Director for Infection Prevention, and she's with us on the line from Elm Grove this morning. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
So this is, on one hand, a story, Ebola, that's currently playing out thousands of miles from here, but it's hard to follow the story without some level of concern. Should we in Wisconsin be concerned about this story because of the disease itself, or for how it speaks to maybe the more general danger of a fast-spreading epidemic of any kind?
What is important for those of us in Wisconsin to know is accurate information about any communicable disease. This one currently that we're focusing on is Ebola. It is the largest epidemic that we have seen, specifically in West Africa. So it's getting a lot of media play, and it's important that we get accurate and calm information into the hands of those that need it.
You stress the word calm there, and I wonder if, as someone who deals in infection and infectious disease prevention, does it concern you when you see very large headlines and sort of very alarming news like this?
It's important to get the right information to the right people, and so that's why we stress with Aurora Healthcare the information that those frontline caregivers need to get to be able to accurately identify, isolate, and prevent diseases, especially with Ebola virus. That is the crux of preventing any further transmission.
Well, and so you work in this field. Can you talk about the significance of how Ebola is spread?
Absolutely. Ebola has been around since the 1970s, so it's well known how Ebola spreads from person to person. You have a sick patient with Ebola, and their bodily secretions are considered infectious. So if someone comes in contact with those bodily secretions and it enters their body through either an open cut or sore or their mucous membranes, then that person is infected as well. So sick Ebola patients transmit the disease through their bodily secretions to another person through an open cut in their skin, an open sore, or through their mucous membrane.
The kinds of fast-moving epidemics we confront most often in this country are typically things like influenza, which seem to be maybe a more readily communicable disease?
Each communicable disease has their mode of transmission that's different. What's common in communicable diseases are three things. You have to have a host or something that is the reservoir for the disease, a mode of transmission, meaning the way that disease goes from one person to another or the vehicle to another, and then a susceptible host. The method of influenza spreading is different than the method of how Ebola spreads. So what's important to know is how the these things, what their modes of transmission are, and how to stop that chain of events, how to stop that mode of transmission.
There are a couple of messages that we often hear in the coverage of the Ebola outbreak. One is that this is a more mobile world than it's ever been, people traveling faster to more places than they have, which poses a danger. And at the same time, medicine knows more about disease transmission than it ever has. Do those two factors cancel each other out in a way?
That's a great question. What is very important is that we have an increased level of awareness when there are these communicable diseases about, so that we can prepare and have, if we have a patient presenting to us, know what to do to prevent further spread.
Well, and so I would imagine that health systems like Aurora do have some plan in place for what you would do if a case of, you know, say, Ebola or any other exotic infectious disease were to present itself in southeastern Wisconsin.
Absolutely. We have communicable disease response, an extremely strong team of infection preventionists at each hospital and covering our clinics and covering our VNA. And what our role is to be alert of what communicable diseases are at the local level, the state level, the national level, and the world level. And we have great partnerships with local public health, state public health, and national public health, being the CDC, that keeps us updated as to what's going on. When we get that information, then we have to translate it into vehicles so that we can disseminate the information to those caregivers that need the accurate information.
And so there is coordination even within, you know, the greater Milwaukee area between you and public health officials and even other hospital systems as well.
Absolutely. That's the crux of preventing any communicable disease. Community is part of the communicable disease definition, so you have to be aware of what's going on. It's not isolated in a certain specific area. Because of the mode of transmission, it can infect many.
What are the kinds of questions you most often hear from people who are perhaps alarmed by the Ebola outbreak?
Sure. Should we be concerned? Many that you have voiced earlier. How do you treat it? How do you prevent it? And luckily, we know how to prevent it. You isolate these cases. You wear personal protective equipment in the form of gloves, gowns, face masks, goggles, and you want to prevent that direct contact with the infectious secretions. And knowing that the treatment, because this is a virus, is supportive, that you can't give a vaccine, you can't give an antibiotic, but you want to support the body with fluids, with oxygen, with perhaps dialysis for the kidneys, so that the body can heal itself.
And I gather one of the other factors working in favor of Western countries is just access to things like clean water and a sterile environment.
Precisely. The infrastructure and the public health infrastructure of developed countries has an advantage over what's occurring right now in Western Africa. And that's why we're seeing this outbreak be so dramatic, because those infrastructures are not in place.
Would you imagine that the time will come that we will someday see a case of Ebola emerge in this country?
I hope not. I think our public health infrastructure and the way the CDC works with border control, customs, and with their quarantine stations, that there have been outbreaks since the 1970s and we haven't seen a case, and I hope that continues.
Angela Tanasi, thank you so much for adding some perspective to the story for us.
My pleasure. Have a great day.
Dr. Angela Tanasi is the System Director of Infection Prevention for Aurora Healthcare. She joined us by phone from Elm Grove. A break now, and then the history of a notorious North Shore house and its future 50 miles away. We'll learn more as Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. If you grew up in the Milwaukee area a few decades ago, you knew it as the Witch's House. Tucked down a dead-end road in Fox Point, the wild rumors were put to rest 10 or 15 years ago as more became known about the house's inhabitant, artist Mary Knoll. The house sits behind a forest of trees and concrete sculptures on one side and Lake Michigan on the other. It's nothing like anything else on the block or really in the area. And therein lies the rub. It's become a de facto tourist attraction, and the neighbors say they're tired of the street's guests at all hours of the day and night. They worry what would happen if the house was turned into a museum, which Knowles fans would like to see. But that's now a moot point because Sheboygan's John Michael Kohler Art Museum is moving the entire thing somewhere about 50 miles away. Matthew Redden writes about the saga of the house in the August issue of Milwaukee Magazine, and he talked with Dan Harmon about the house's intriguing history.
Well, I guess, that's kind of how it comes first to everyone's mind, even the people who know it as a piece of art. They kind of say, oh, this used to be the witch's house, and now it's, you know, as things evolve, it's kind of become this vernacular art. It's a word that's used a lot. An artist's environment is another one. So even in the minds of those people who are looking at it as a piece of art, it's still kind of very much that's the way it's looked at.
At what point did this become a story worthy of a magazine? Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems, when did it transition from her just being an enigma or no one knowing anything about her
right.
to being art that's argued over, sought after, a big neighborhood conflict?
Mm-hmm. I think it is that conflict that made it kind of noteworthy. I mean, it's definitely an interesting piece in and of itself, especially with it being one of the only works of outsider art or vernacular art done by a woman. But I think the thing that made it kind of this magazine-worthy piece, the fact that there was such a strong reaction to it when they wanted to build it into a museum. Because people I spoke to in the neighborhood didn't seem to care whether it was there or not. As much as they did, they didn't want it to be a museum. They were very, very opinionated about that specifically. So I think it's the fight that really kind of made it into this larger story.
And what's in the media now is that they're going to move the house, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
The Kohler Museum in Sheboygan, right? Okay. They're going to physically move the house somehow mm-hmm. to 50 miles away, right?
Right.
And that's creating a whole other level of controversy, mm-hmm. right?
Right, because, I mean, it's obviously a huge undertaking. It doesn't seem like something they've done quite in the same way before. They've moved other exhibits from other areas but not reassembled them then in a similar situation. So it's a big undertaking, yeah.
And a whole different type of controversy, mm-hmm. those that say that it should stay where it is because that's part of the history
right.
of the whole thing, right?
Yeah, and I know they want to put it somewhere on the lake, but, you know, it's an art that is defined by its environment, so it's kind of very controversial whether you can take something out of its natural physical environment and rebuild it and still have that same, you know, element of artist, majesty, you know, all that stuff.
Now, what was the neighborhood opposition? Just because of traffic?
Traffic is the main concern, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone I spoke to kind of was concerned about traffic. You know, there's already neighborhood concerns about people coming up to the lake in general because it's one of the few places you can get access to the lake. There were, I think, in the past some issues with shuttles coming up, tour buses. And so I think that kind of just gave them a bad impression of it from the beginning.
And this is something the Kohler Museum said that they've gone back and forth on. And
mm-hmm.
they said, and according to your article, that they've exhausted all options
yeah.
at this point.
Yeah. At this point, it seems like their only other option would have been to turn it into a private residence again, which is what they did at the beginning of the process. After the first set of opposition, they, you know, had someone move in, they had them take care of the house, and then the house just kind of sat empty and not being open to the public. But as I talk about in the story, you know, the financial costs of doing that at this point had kind of become insurmountable.
Now, I've been to museums where mm-hmm. you don't actually drive up to it and park. You actually have to park your car, I think it was like a mile away, and then
right.
you're shuttled in a tiny little shuttle to the mm-hmm. museum. Was that something looked at? I mean, that seems to me like if they wanted to keep it as a museum, that would be the least.
Yeah, that was one thing they considered. There was a fundraiser where they basically did just that. They had people over at a house that was further away from the Mary Knoll home, and then they shuttled people in to visit the site. But that kind of caused the same set of problems with the neighbors. You know, that for them, that wasn't enough of a concession to make. In the most recent plans, they did have a parking lot built in. The property is large enough that they could have built a modest parking lot for a tour bus or a single car. So that would have reduced the traffic. But again, at that point, the neighbors were so, you know, entrenched against this plan that it wasn't a concession that they were able to make.
What do you know about where it's going to be moved? I mean, is this a done deal or is there
it's,
room
the move
to back
is
out?
A done deal, as to my understanding. I don't know if they have any plans as to yet where they're going to move it. I know it's going to be in the Sheboygan, Kohler area on the lake. But to my understanding, there isn't a place in mind yet. At this point, it seems like the Kohler's main concern is, cataloging what's left, doing restorations, looking at the physical items because some of them, you know, they're not made to be moved. They're made to stay there. So, I mean, just figuring out the logistics of getting them from one place to the other, I think, is their primary concern.
And for those that aren't familiar with the house, I mean, some of the art is the house itself, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, art built into the house. There's carvings on the walls. There's a little doormat that has the word boo written on it. You know, all of that stuff is part of the artist's environment. All of it has to get cataloged and moved independently. So it's just a very huge undertaking.
What did you find out in your research about, has this been done before successfully moving, actually just moving a house that's considered art?
Yeah. I mean, it's not a thing that's usually done very often. You know, like I said, the Kohler has moved artist environments before, but they usually don't move them with the intent of reestablishing them in the way that I think they plan to with the Knoll House. They've got extensive archives and they've got them all cataloged away and they can reset them in their gallery. They just reset one called the Healing Machine a couple years ago, which was normally a freestanding structure similar to the Mary Knoll House. And instead of, you know, recrafting it somewhere in Sheboygan, they have it in their archives. They can bring it up, present it in their galleries, and then, you know, in that sense, recreate it.
And I've actually been to a couple of, I guess they would be considered living museums or sculptors that actually have sculptures on their properties and you can go visit. And you did mention something in the article about something like that.
Right. They do have a couple of those. You know, those are situations where they are able to preserve it intact or in situ. The one that's up in Sheboygan I went to is it's a path and it has these sculptures along it. And they were able to preserve that where it was. Even though it was in the middle of a residential community, it wasn't quite the same, you know, neighborhood opposition, social class issues as existed here on Beach Drive.
How unique is that? That it is kind of, in a way, a class issue and quality of life issue for the neighborhood?
Or right.
This is such it's almost, you know, basically a dead-end road. And you can't blame people for wanting to keep their tranquility, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's obviously an issue there that is different than a lot of the other things the Kohlers had to deal with. In talking to people, I did, you know, learn of other places where that was the case, and they came to different agreements. There's one that's out in, I believe, Maine where, you know, it's a museum now, but there's still a lot of opposition with the neighbors about who can show up, when can they show up. The Chipstone Foundation kind of had to deal with some of the same issues when it was started up because it's in another kind of high-class area. And, you know, that creates its own problems because the people who live in neighborhoods that are more affluent have more resources at their disposal. You know, one of the main people in opposition to this is a retired lawyer who is now on the municipal board. I mean, that's something that a lot of neighborhoods don't have, you know, to counter that sort of thing.
Something that you don't really quite say in the article, but I'm going to choose to read between the lines. But here, did Kohler, do you think, mishandle this? I mean, in a way, it's a kind of an unprecedented situation. Is there something that they could have done differently or anyone else could have done differently to make this a better situation?
I think one of the things I realized researching the article is that obviously in hindsight, there's stuff that could have been done differently. But I'm not sure also in hindsight that there was much that could be done to resolve the situation. I mean, from the very beginning, the neighborhood was against it being turned into a museum. That position didn't really change. Whether or not you think that position is valid or whether that should outweigh the artistic merits of it, the way the municipal system is set up in Fox Point kind of stacks the deck in the favor of the residents versus the Kohler. So, I mean, there's probably things that I think the Kohler Center could have done differently to preserve the art itself. If they just decided to move it, say, 10 years ago instead of waiting, it wouldn't have, you know, been affected by the environments quite as much. But also 10 years ago, I don't think they really thought that it was going to be an issue. I think they kind of thought, you know, we'll lay low, we'll let it blow over, new people will move in, they'll understand, you know. It wasn't a bad choice to make. It just didn't turn out for the best.
Now, when did Mary Knoll pass away?
2001.
Did she make her wishes known?
It kind of depends on who you ask. I mean, she was kind of a very private woman. She had very complex opinions. You know, you ask some people and they say that, you know, she went to these galleries of her jewelry and she really liked that people were able to see it. Then you talk to other people who say that she was a very private woman. She didn't want people coming in and looking at all her things. So, I mean, it's kind of a situation where it's almost too bad that she's not around to give her opinion because now people are just forced to extrapolate based on what they knew of her and how they understood her wishes.
Yeah, you said that she encountered an attorney at one point and that didn't go so well.
It did not go well, no. Yeah. Yeah, and it was one of those situations where I was talking to Ruth Kohler about it, and she said that was almost kind of the end of it. You know, they didn't talk for a while, and it was just kind of through luck that, you know, negotiations and talking to some of Mary's friends that they were able to renegotiate again.
Is there at least consensus that it's a good thing that it's going to be saved, even if not in the original location?
Yeah, I think that's how the broader consensus is forming now, especially since they had the forum at the Art Museum and Ruth Kohler came and spoke. I was actually personally a little surprised that it was taken so well, but I think part of it for most of the people who weren't involved in the process was just the surprise of discovering that, you know, all of this had been going on behind the scenes. And just to hear Ruth Kohler explain the situation, I think, was very helpful for a lot of people.
What's going to be done with the land?
The plan, as far as I know, is that the land will be sold as a way to fund the move. So, you know, in 5-10 years, there could be a regular house on Beach Drive where Mary Knoll's house used to be.
Will that stop people from driving by and just looking at the old site then? I don't know.
I don't know. I guess we'll have to find out.
Well, what's next for the whole process then?
The process now is just going to be for the Kohler Center to, you know, figure out, you know, the best way to move it, the financial costs of that, you know, cataloging it, make sure it's all done correctly. And it doesn't sound like they have a timeline in place for that.
And there's probably no way of getting around disassembling the house. I don't think they're going to be able to do a whole house move up that road.
They were considering at one point trying to put it on a boat and taking it up the lake. But it just wasn't possible with the way the shoreline is constructed over there. And then they probably could have just picked up the house and floated it, you know, straight north. But yeah, it seems like they're going to have to deconstruct the house, rebuild it, possibly using some materials that were not in the original construction. Just because, I mean, the house is about 100 years old now. You know, it was built when Mary was a child, and, you know, it's been a long time since then.
And I think one of the things you said that pushed them into this decision was the flood damage that wasn't too long ago. Did that damage any art? I mean, was there stuff in the basement that got flooded and destroyed?
There was stuff in the basement that got damaged. I don't think there was any large-scale destruction. I think a lot of the art that was in the basement was in storage, so it kind of had a little bit of safety in that sense. And it didn't come up into the first floor of the house, which would have very much wreaked some damage on, you know, the carpeting, the furniture, all of that. So that was actually kind of a stroke of luck, as it turned out.
Well, Matthew Redden, thank you for writing this article. It was interesting to read something we've all known about for quite a while.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right, thank you.
Writer Matthew Redden's article on the Mary Knoll House is in the August issue of Milwaukee Magazine. Redden is assistant editor at the Wisconsin Gazette. He spoke with Dan Harmon, and there's a link to the article from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Another break now, and then the latest installment in our series, Listening to Mitchell. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. Sonia Thompson and Adam Carr are Milwaukee-based artists who work together to create site-specific public art projects. Their most recent is named Listening to Mitchell, and they're sharing audio postcards from the project here on Fridays until the end of September. Here is this week's piece.
Listening to Mitchell is an installation of image and sound that transforms over 50 interviews into an experience of place and its collective memory. The installation is currently on the street, woven through historic Mitchell Street's 7 blocks from the Majeska to St. Stan's. And throughout its duration, we are sharing the voices and the sounds of Mitchell Street here on Lake Effect.
Go out and play.
Marbles. Marbles was huge. Kickball.
Football.
Hopscotch.
On the swings.
Throwing rocks at each other.
And flipping cards. Baseball cards. Oh my gosh, that was huge. We would flip baseball cards like for hours.
Okay, so you'd have a baseball card. Now there's a baseball card with the face of the player on it.
You knew all the baseball players. You knew the best baseball players.
Babe Ruth.
Hank Aaron.
Lay them out and you'd say, which two do you want?
Well, I want that Mantle card.
We're going to flip 10 times.
I had a special way of...
So, you know, like everybody has a certain way of...
Everybody has a certain way of flipping cards, you know.
Everything was like, you know, you'd run home, go get something to eat, back out, back home, eat, back out. They would come by and pick me up about 5 or 6, and then we'd go deliver the papers, and then after we delivered the papers, we'd go to Greeby's first, and we'd get, like, I always got a cruller. He always got, I think, a Long John or whatever. Because they always made me go to the dark, down the dark in the back. They gave me donuts, and I was happy. I got donuts and a chocolate milk. The treat was because we'd go up the fire escape, and we'd be by the roof, and we'd sit there and hang our feet over the edges and swing our feet, and we'd sit on the fire escape eating and drinking our chocolate milk. And that, to me, was like a huge treat, you know, because I could hang out with my brothers especially.
Listening to Mitchell is on Mitchell Street from the Majeska to St. Stan's until the end of September. Guides to the installation are available at businesses on Mitchell Street and throughout the city. There's more information at listeningtomitchell.org. So do you have plans to go anywhere this Labor Day weekend? Lake Effect essayist Joel Habish advises you to keep your eye out for construction on the Zoo Interchange or the Hone Bridge or I-94 between here and Kenosha or, well, just about everywhere.
Hello, Orange Barrel Company. We're always ready to drum up more business. Let's roll up the barrels. Orange, you glad you called?
No, I'm not so sure. You certainly seem happy.
Why not? This is our busiest year ever. You called to order some barrels, didn't you?
Why, yes. I'm Deputy Sub-Administrator of the Bureau of Roads, Bridges, and Other Stuff in the Greater Milwaukee Area. This is Jerry Mander.
Hey, Ralph. Tell the boss we gotta put on another shift, another order from Milwaukee. Jer, we usually deal with your contractor, Louie.
Yes, but he's been hospitalized for overwork and stress. He left a note saying, get more barrels. Everybody in his company is already working overtime, so we're stepping in to keep things moving.
Gotcha. Okay, I just called up the file on this here situation in southeastern Wisconsin. You got your construction going on everywhere. Massive Zoo Interchange project, auxiliary roads, feeder bridges, record-shattering and axle-shattering potholes, plus a total surface redo on the Hone Bridge. Yeah, about time, I'd say.
That's right. I think we need to order a bazillion orange barrels.
I don't think that's going to be enough. I'd suggest a gazillion. I see the county, city, suburbs, feds, and states aren't sharing any planning, and since nobody wants to be outdone, everything's happening at once. So if a portion of the freeway is down to a half lane in each direction, the adjacent roads that would normally be available are also hopelessly torn up.
You're right. You can't get there from here. Anywhere. I just saw my neighbor come out on his driveway, get in his car, check his GPS, then talk to OnStar, then turn off the motor, get out of his car, and go slowly back into the house.
Yeah, there's a lot of that going around. Now, you know when you order in that larger quantity, you'll save money, and what the heck am I talking about? You're a governmental entity. What do you care about saving money?
Yes. Well, anyway, so the additional barrels that we buy should be delivered.
Hold on there, cowboy. You don't buy these things. You rent them. And since your contractor is otherwise ocupado, you can rent them directly from us. Just pennies a day. A whole lot of pennies. Now, how much tape can I put you down for?
I'm sorry?
Tape? We got all the products to go along with barrels. Warning tape, pylons, cones, barricades, and signs that read, slow down. This is a work zone. The whole kit and caboodle.
How much will all that rental cost?
Not much for the kit. The caboodle could run you some money. By the way, the industry term for the orange barrels is channelizers.
I see.
Or delineators, if you so prefer.
Oh, and we'll need plenty of, what do you call those sawhorse thingies with blinking reflectors?
The industry term is sawhorse thingies with blinking reflectors.
I guess we can afford that rental for a year.
Ralph, you gotta hear this guy. He's a gem.
Sure.
The name is Algernon.
Algernon?
You got a problem with that?
No, certainly not. No problem. But what do you mean by this guy's a gem?
I kid. No, that was precious, that bit about returning some of the barrels, like you won't need to rent them again next year and the years after that.
Years?
You bet. All of southeastern Wisconsin is in for it. I hate to spread gloom, but after all this, you can't tell me you don't believe we're on the eve of construction.
Lake Effect essayist Joel Habish is a freelance copywriter who lives in West Allis. He's past president of Working Writers of Wisconsin and worked for years at ad agencies in Milwaukee and Chicago. Another break now, and then two Turkish musicians collaborate for the first time at a performance tomorrow in Brookfield. We'll learn more when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Teich. Considering the musical worlds in which they live, it's perhaps surprising that Turkish-American composer Kamran Ince and Turkish-American composer, multi-instrumentalist, and academic scholar Mehmet Ali Sanlikol have never worked together before. Until now. Thanks to Milwaukee's Present Music and Ince's long association with the organization, the two will jointly present a concert of Ince's work tomorrow evening in Brookfield. The instrument that Sanlikol will feature is a ney, a flute made from cane that's essentially remained unchanged for centuries. Ince Sanlikol and Thanae joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North in the studio recently, and Ince explained how he and Sanlikol finally came together.
I'm one of the founders of this school in Istanbul. It's at Istanbul Technical University. It's called MIAM. And I go there four times a year. And Mehmet Ali, with his jazz ensemble from Boston, gave a concert. And he played all these Turkish instruments. He played piano. He sang. He's really an amazing jazz musician. And a lot of the pieces I had heard about 10 years before that. Some CDs were given to me. And I always thought how amazingly good jazz compositions they were. Well, but I didn't know they were his. So I went up to him and introduced myself, and then we met, when I knew we were going to do this concert and play this version of this piece, I knew Mehmet would be a great musician to join us.
It's just wonderful that you connected after all these years of doing your own musical journeys. Mm-hmm. And never crossing over. Somehow I would have thought that you would just because
of
your interest.
I've certainly heard of, you know, Kamuran İnce, that's for sure. Kamuran has been around, you know, and certainly an established and accomplished composer. So I've heard of him through friends and so on and so forth, as well as his, you know, premieres in Turkey and around the States. But somehow we've never met in person.
So tell me about this piece that that you are going to be playing on. Did you write it for him?
No, I wrote it 3 years ago. There's this concert series in Istanbul called Bach Before and After. And the impresario is a really close friend of mine. So he'll program Bach done in various interesting ways, but also he'll program some music that is somehow related in, you know, of course you can be very free with that, how it's related. So he wanted, there's this great ney player, Kutsi Ergüner, who lives in Paris. He was going to come with his cellist, and they were giving a concert, and he wanted me to compose a piece for the two of them. So I love the idea, and also the cello being in it, and Bach, this concert series is Bach. You know, how can you not be somehow, of course, thinking about Bach a little bit? But I'm also at the same time really thinking about, you know, the ney and Ottoman court music and the spirituality, all of that. And Asumani, the name means according to the skies. So it's, you know, skies means, of course, you know, deity, God, you know, reaching out to that. I don't know. What would you like to say about it?
Well, yeah, I've been exploring it and listening to it and working on it for over a month now. And I think that Kamuran managed and accomplished in the piece is this wonderful marriage of creating a beautiful soundscape and somehow having the ney be featured in its actually natural manner on top of that soundscape. It really accomplishes a wonderful mood.
Well, describe the ney, because I think there are probably a lot of people who don't know what that
is. Sure. So it's an end-blown flute. It's made out of cane. In Turkey alone, however, has a special place, this instrument. It immediately communicates mysticism to people of Turkey. And although the connection is to the beloved mystic and poet Celaleddin Rumi, I'm sure a lot of people have heard of him, most people, regardless of religion, if they're living in Turkey, the minute they hear the sound of this instrument, they immediately make this mystical connection. And they may not know, you know, or they may not necessarily be aware of the fact that Rumi started his most famous work, the Mesnevi, with the story of the reed. And so in that story, of course, the ney, the reed, the cane flute, is a metaphor for human spirit and soul.
So in some ways, it's almost a divine instrument.
In Turkey. You know, the funny thing is, you step into Syria, it becomes a flute. They can play it next to a belly dancer. In Turkey, if you do that, you'll certainly attract some
unwanted attention.
Yeah.
Can we hear a little? There are different keys, I'm assuming.
Because it's a cane flute, it just has seven holes on it, and so in a way, it is one instrument that stayed true to its earlier forms, because, you know, when you look at Turkish music or Middle Eastern music overall, many instruments evolved, kind of like, you know, if not as great an evolution as the piano lived, for example, still, you know, many, many instruments like the kanun, which is a, let's call it a horizontal harp, or a tambur, a long-necked lute. These instruments certainly went through evolution. This one?
Pretty much the way it was.
Yeah, it's just more or less the same. There's something about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's something about that.
Because really, it doesn't, I mean, how can it change? After you hear it, you'll know what we're talking about.
Yeah. Well, I guess the only thing really that could change is if you added keys, which would change it, and if you added a different kind of mouthpiece.
Well, here's the thing. First of all, if you think about the evolution of flutes in Europe, you know, they were first made out of wood, eventually, you know, different kind of wood, then finally metal in most cases. So a lot of things could happen. The point is, they didn't.
They haven't.
Yeah. So.
And all the inflections on this instrument, in the quarter tone inflections, he's able to do without extra key holes.
Right.
So that's breath.
Pressure, breath,
positioning,
sometimes positioning, and half fingerings. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, before we hear it, Turkish music is traditionally in quarter tone scales. Is that unlike that?
Makams, they do have,
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
More like the Arabic music as opposed to Western European music, which is.
If I may just make an intervention here, I would put the music of Turkey in between, you know, the characteristics of Arab music and European music. These microtonalities that we're speaking of resemble more Europe and Arab, you know, quarter tones all at the same time. They're in between.
It's sort of the way the Ottoman Empire was.
Or Turkey, kind of, Turkey happens
in Turkey
to be.
Now, yeah, bridging, exactly. Yeah, bridging between Europe and the Middle East,
There's, of course, a lot that can be said about that, but
We're just talking about
exactly.
Music. So let's hear this wonderful instrument.
Sure, let me give you a little bit of a demonstration.
To say it raises the hairs on the back of my neck because it sounds like music I grew up listening to.
Yeah.
Awesome. I don't know if the Armenians use the same thing, but oh my goodness.
I wouldn't be surprised. I know for a fact that I did a lot of studying of reading lots of memorials written by musicians of Istanbul. Of course, a good number of them were Armenians. I've heard of Armenian musicians and composers who would pick up the ney and, you know, create the same aesthetic. So I would not be surprised.
So, Kamran, when you hear these tones, what does it do for you as a composer? Where do you go?
Well, one thing I do, you know, when I use an instrument like this or any other ethnic instrument, they are incredible. They're beautiful. They're so moving with what they do. So I don't take this instrument, and when I'm going to use this in a piece with a cello, I'm not going to use this like a Western flute, like a flute cello duo, trying to get sounds out of it that a normal flute, no. I mean, why am I using it then? That's no, I only want to use this for what this instrument does best. That's where I start from. And, you know, Mehmet is extremely knowledgeable in the inner workings of Turkish music, the makams and the everything. I am, but more in an intuitive way, not in a theoretical way. So all these makams, all these different scales, you know, normally in the Turkish classical, we call it Turkish classical music, Ottoman court music, the composers will say, okay, I'm in this makam scale. Oh, in this piece, I'm going to go to this other makam. Then I'm going to come to this makam, and then, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It's almost like in a Western, like a Western composer will start, I'm going to start in C major, then I'm going to go to, you know, relative G major, whatever, relative minor. Just like I compose, I use some tonal sonorities in my music. And when I'm doing it, I never want to say, oh, man, that's like a second inversion C major chord. Oh, man, because of that, I must use A flat, you know, no. I mean, you know, that's just, it's extremely boring and not kind of organic for me. So there I don't think about it. Here, when I write music, so when I was writing this Asumani, you know, I'm working with all these pedal points, all these different makams. And later people will come and tell me, hey, man, you know, you used a Sabah makam and you went to Sijah Hijah. Don't tell me. Don't tell me. I know. You know, oh, really good. You know, I don't want, you know, I don't want to start from there. So I'm hearing it. It's kind of, I make it all my kind of own world. And, you know, I'm sure Mehmet can tell us what makams I'm using, but don't tell me.
Don't, he doesn't want to know. He doesn't want to know.
Yeah.
Well, and I love the fact that you're mixing this wonderful ethnic sound, very specific sound, with the Western cello, which is, again, a very specific sound. But the melding of the two is what I love, that idea.
Yeah, and the cello, the way I'm using the cello, there's a lot of, you know, I mean, not extreme extended techniques or anything, but alternative sounds that you're going to hear from the cello to create that environment for the ney to exist on top.
Exactly.
And then you're going to hear Bach-like movements in cello too, which, of course, how can you not with a cello?
Right.
So
Bach would have loved this, I think.
Yeah.
I think he would have.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, he was, you know, listening to his harmonies and where he went in things. I can absolutely imagine him thinking, oh, I can do something with that.
Yeah. The genius that he was.
Absolutely. Present music is such a great companion for you, Kamran. I mean, how many times have you been here?
Oh, boy.
Can you even count?
I mean, I probably have been here 25, 30 times.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they have commissioned about more than a dozen works from me. But when I say they, I mean it could be present music itself. It could be like a national consortium. It could be audience individual members. It could be audience collectively. It can be board members. You name it. I received all. I mean, all of the above. Plus, for about 4 or 5 years, there was a direct flight from Memphis to here. I was the pianist also of present music. So I would come and play piano in the group. And that was a lot of fun. So, yeah, we have a long history and, you know, I'm at home.
Very fruitful collaboration.
Yes, very.
So, Mehmet, is this the first time you've been here to play with this group?
Sure is.
Are you looking forward to maybe coming back?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Sure. Absolutely.
I mean, it is such a creative group of people and really pushing, you know, the forefront
of
music.
Certainly looks like it, yeah. Really very happy to be here.
Well, and Mehmet has, I think, also your opening and with the halves, I believe, with
Kevin, Kevin came up with this idea.
I know. Yeah. So what are they? We should.
Well, I don't remember how it came about, but at some point
he heard your music.
Okay. Well, basically, it was I'm going to open with an improvisation on a double reed instrument, which
zurna.
Is zurna, a very loud outdoor type of instrument.
But you can't hear the bass drum next to it.
Right.
Yes.
It's that kind.
A sham kind of thing?
Exactly.
Okay.
Imagine a sham tripled in volume and intensity.
So you're going to improv on that, and that will start the concert?
He wanted like a fanfare effect, and so we will certainly provide that. And then second half will open most likely with myself on the piano, but mostly using my voice to improvise, and in which I think I'll probably go in and out of Turkish makams and jazz and so on and so forth.
And then we have your
pieces. Yeah, then the rest of the program, five pieces of mine, yes.
Wonderful. Gentlemen, I want to thank you both for coming in and playing a little bit on the ney so that we have an idea of what it sounds like. And Kamran, as always, such a pleasure.
Likewise.
Hope to talk to you again in the near future. And Mehmet, now you too.
Well, thank you very much.
The performance, Ints by Ints, takes place tomorrow evening at the Sharon Lynn Wilson Center for the Arts in Brookfield. It features music by Kamran Ints, as well as ethnomusicologist and multi-instrumentalist Mehmet Ali Sanlikol, who performs on the ney, which we heard earlier in the interview. Ints and Sanlikol spoke with Bonnie North. One last break, and we'll be back with more of Like Effect in just a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Like Effect from WUWM. Finally today, a timeless parable of savings and family love from Like Effect essayist George Burdies.
This is the story of a gentle old grandma, a loving daughter, and a mattress. I almost forgot. It also involves a wild, desperate search at the dump. In the end, it all comes together. Well, sort of, although a happy ending is still uncertain. Let's start with Grandma. There aren't many details, but one thing for sure, she was definitely prudent. She'd been through the hard times, saw the good things in life come and go. That led to a streak of hard-nosed frugality. To put it mildly, she didn't spend carelessly. The daughter was loving and protective of her dear old mom, almost to a fault. She took care of her in every way. And then there's that mattress. We'll get into that in a minute. As to the dump, well, what can I say? Like all disrespectful dumps, it was a smelly depository of rotting garbage, junk, flies, and all the other rejections of society. Although there are periodic exceptions. Grandma is a central character in this true life saga. Although ailing and aging, she still lived alone just over the edge of feisty independence. Daughter came to visit her regularly, checking on her health and well-being, all that a loving daughter should be. One of her abiding concerns regarding Grandma's welfare was making sure she slept well. This is where the aforementioned mattress enters the scene. Like I said, Grandma was frugal, a virtue born of good times lost. But even for old and tottering grandmas, there is a future, and that future usually involves leaving something to their loving and devoted children. But Grandma also knew that the future can be destroyed by dubious investment and failing banks, and so she also planned arduously to keep that nest egg of hers safe and snug. But to do that, she took an unusual path of saving. Ergo, the mattress. Whatever money came in over the years, Grandma put in the only place she decided would be absolutely safe. Yes, yes, she stuffed it into the mattress. Year after fading year into the mattress it was crammed, and each night as she slept soundly she knew her death gift would be there for her devoted daughter. She knew because she could feel its lumps and humps. Meanwhile, that devoted daughter continued her care and thoughtfulness of her mother. One day, while Grandma was out of town, she came to her apartment and decided to do a special thorough cleaning, polishing furniture to a lustrous glow, scrubbing the floor, changing the sheets on the bed. It was while she was changing those sheets that she realized how faded and frumpy the mattress was, and bumpy, too. It was then she decided her beloved mother needed better. And so off she went to buy a new one and arrange for its immediate delivery and the prompt removal of the broken-down relic. She smiled broadly as the antique was carried off by the trashman to the dump. What a wonderful surprise it would be for Grandma to lay her weary body down on that heaven cloud of the new mattress. Night came, and Grandma returned from her travel more than ready for a night of peaceful slumber. But it didn't take her but a prone second on the new mattress to realize something drastic had changed in her absence. Of course, that was confirmed in an alarm clanging second. All those lumps and bumps of money were gone. As of this writing, the guys at the dump are raking through tons of debris buried deep under other tons of garbage. Also, as of this moment, the missing mattress has not been found. Also missing is the estimated $1 million in cash it contained.
George Burdes divides his time between Milwaukee and the North Woods. His essays are collected at his website, East of Eagle River, and many originally aired on WXPR in Rhinelander. He's kindly shared them with us as well. And that is it for the summer. Well, not really, but it does kick off Labor Day weekend, which is kind of the end of the summer. But I hope you have something enjoyable planned. We are produced by Dan Harmon, Bonnie North, and yours truly, with production assistance from Audrey Nowakowski and Eleanor Peterson, web support from Michelle Maternowski, and studio engineering from John Strelecki. I'm Mitch Teich. So great to have you listening today, and I hope we'll be part of your weekend. Lake Effect Weekend comes your way tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Coming your way at noon, it is the latest news on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR in Boston. But right now, it's 11 o'clock, and Fresh Air is next.